Welcome back to the Margins of Riga Stratcom Dialogue 2022. We are now joined by Jean-Christophe Boucher, who is an assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at the University of Calgary in Canada. And presently, his research focuses on applied machine learning in the context of understanding how the digital world shapes the world around us. And he's currently responsible for projects funded by the Department of National Defense to study information operations. Jean-Christophe, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
From my understanding, you conduct really fascinating big data research with regards to misinformation in a range of contexts. So everything ranging from vaccine hesitancy to climate change to, you know, issues of war and peace. Could you maybe sketch out some of the research that you're doing just so our viewers get a better idea?
Sure. So most of my research focuses on the impact of social media and politics, and more specifically, so foreign policy. It's not a field that is very big, and most people working in that field are either not in data analytics or they're focusing more on foreign policy. So merging these two things were interesting for me. And a while back during the Crimean War, we built a project looking at Ukrainian mobilizations, Ukrainian diasporic mobilization in Canada, and how it had an impact on Canadian position toward the conflict. There's this big argument in Canada that the Ukrainians are shaping Canadians' foreign policy toward Russia, and we wanted to see if that was true. So we started projects in 2012, 13, 14 on those things. And of course, you know, as the time went by, the digital space and digital media plays a greater role in everyone's life. It used to be a little bit marginal, and some of the research showed at that time that, you know, the relationship between real life and on-life political participation were not there. Now there's a clear indication that younger Canadians or younger anyone have this kind of real life online interaction, and absolutely people have a tendency to participate more on both scales. So we start to build these projects and also kind of building this, the machine learning applications to these things, which was kind of the technical challenge. And as we grew into this research projects, then we've been asked by different actors, you know, the public health agencies, pharmaceutical companies, to start to help them understand the social media space, start to help them design machine learning applications to measure sentiment, emotions, narratives, to help them better kind of design communication strategies in the social media space.
So just to maybe clarify or build on this somehow, you are collecting mountains, volumes of data on Russian, Chinese, maybe other disinformation in Canada. Could you maybe a bit explain what sort of malign narratives are the ones that are taking root most effectively? What narratives are finding fertile ground in Canadian society, maybe to the point that they're actually being parroted by credible sources?
Right. We have a project on populism and in the US and social media. We have a project on vaccine hesitancy, and one is on Russian, pro-Russian narratives in Canada. And what we find is a couple of things. On one hand, we find that there's actually kind of two vectors of influence of pro-Russian narratives in Canada. One comes from the US. So Canadian, you know, social media space is influenced heavily by American social media interactions. And what we see is that some actors in the US, Tulsi Gabbard, Candace Oh, Tucker Carlson, those on the right who are pushing for pro-Russian narratives actually have a huge impact on Canadians. We see them start to tweet, for example, in the US, and then after a couple of while, you know, Canadians' account, especially on the rights, will start to retweet them, and then that becomes essentially diffusing the Canadian social media ecosystem. And then there's a more a Russian-centric vector, WikiLeaks, Grant Greenwald, and RT, and coming through like international and other kinds of vectors. So in a sense, if you look at the misinformation space in Canada, it comes from two sectors. We're infected by American narratives and we're infected by international narratives, and that comes together in Canada. What we find in that thing is essentially like the when we do machine learning applications, we in clustering, we find that there's like essentially four big narratives that are pushed in Canada that has any traction in the pro-Russian space. The first big argument that we find is one essentially legitimizing Russian invasion based on NATO expansionism. The Russians or people pushing pro-Russian narratives are saying, you know, the reason why Russia invaded Ukraine is because NATO is expanding in the Baltic states, elsewhere, and that's the reason why we're there. And that has the most impact, essentially accusing NATO of that. The second argument is a little bit tied to this, is the notion that NATO is using Ukraine as a proxy to wage war on Russia. That in fact, NATO is an aggressive expansionist alliance, and it uses other actors to fight their wars, but it's really a NATO-Russia problem. The third one, and so those are the main, I'd say like 80% of narratives that pushing pro-Russian arguments are those two. Then there's a third one about, you know, denazifying, and that, you know, in essence, there's Nazis in Ukraine. That doesn't have a lot of impact in Canada. And the last one is one that really what we call like mistrust in institution, the assumption that globalists and George Soros and international forces and the World Economic Forum are responsible for the war, and that really the Canadian government is just really a puppet of international actors that want to keep Russia down. So we see the four of them playing, but the most damaging one is the expansionist argument.
You mentioned that the Canadian social media space is very much influenced by trends and developments in the US.
Yeah.
And I had a really interesting conversation with an expert at this conference who said that in the US, of course, the January 6th insurrection, the events at the tragic events at the US Capitol brought to light the extent to which the problem of kind of political violence or homegrown domestic extremism was not identified properly, and to what extent it still slushes around all around all corners of the internet. Do you see any similar dynamics in Canada? Is the threat of domestic extremism or radicalization, polarization, do you see similar trends?
We do. Most of it is influenced by American social media. And that's one of the issues that we have when you think of foreign interference or foreign influence. One of the conversations we have internally is that our problem is the Americans. It's not the Russians, not the Chinese. Is if we could deal with the American social media space, and if they could deal with their polarization and somehow find ways to have a more sane conversations about issue, it would help Canadians a lot. Also, Canadians are like watch Fox News, and there's like a direct connection to the US. It doesn't have to go through other actors within the Canadian space or Trojan horses. It just has to go through directly through Fox News. And we're finding more and more that Canadians, especially on the right and on the far right, who have a tendency to emulate, watch, and be influenced by American media, starts to get arguments about American media. One of the problems we had recently was what we call like the Freedom Convoy. So during the COVID pandemic, there was a huge group of truckers and far right and white extremists who built a convoy of trucks and drove from Calgary, unfortunately, you know, my province.
From your town?
And up to Canada. It's a long drive. It's like 7,000, you know, kilometers. Wow. It's a huge thing. And then they went to Ottawa and they stayed there. There was some of them depicted, you know, white supremacist symbols. And all of this was really interesting, A, because it took Canadian authorities really by surprise. They didn't think it would kind of become and escalate. And secondly, they didn't think that it would be such like anchored toward like the white extremists. And the third one was these people were talking like Americans. For example, at one point we had people say in that convoy, like I got arrested and Ontario Police Force didn't read me my Miranda rights. And we're like, that's not a thing in Canada. Like you actually have no Miranda rights in Canada, and there's the process to an arrest is not the same thing. There were people, for example, saying that, you know, they had a First Amendment right for free speech. And we were telling them like that doesn't exist in
Invoking
Canada.
Invoking the US Constitution.
They were, right? And I think this is one of the problems that I have, especially with like the conversation about free speech and tech industry, is that a lot of this conversation is very American-based and is built upon American values and their understanding of democracy. The problem is, like, the Americans don't have a monopoly of what democracy is, and there's other democratic systems and countries who have a different view of what this is. The American system is designed around individualism and freedom of speech and a little bit about chaos, right? They came out of chaos and they like the chaos and they think that out of chaos will get order. The Canadians come from the British, and our views are very different about how you design your society. And we put a lot more stocks into minority rights. We have Francophones, we have Indigenous nations, we have all sorts of population who needs to be protected from the majority. So we want people to have freedom of speech, but it has to be within the normal tendencies and the normal part. So all this conversation with America and tech platforms and Canadian space really infuses how we have this conversation. It's frustrating for Canadians to see how much, you know, it doesn't have the impact of Canadian norms in it.
You mentioned a fascinating thing about Russian hostile disinformation operations targeting the Ukrainian diaspora in Canada. And this, at least in my mind, linked up with another thing I heard on a panel yesterday about Russia increasingly targeting countries in Europe that host large populations of Ukrainian refugees, promoting all sorts of malign narratives about these refugees, conducting rapes or different types of crimes or looting or destabilizing, challenging our way of life and so on. What makes diaspora or refugee populations a particularly kind of good target for these operations? What is the objective behind these sorts of attacks?
That's a good question. So Canada has the largest Ukrainian diaspora in the world after Russia. We have about 1.5, 1.6 Canadians who self-identify as Ukrainian. That's about 5% of our population, and they're extremely important in the prairies and certain province. So it's a massive group. On top of that, you know, on top of Ukrainians, you have a lot of Latvians and Poles and a lot of Eastern Europeans who have had a difficult relationship with Russia in the past. So in Canada, you have like this big group of Canadians who self-identify, keeps relationships with Eastern Europe and Central Europe and try to promote democracy from there. So these diasporas are kind of the bridge between Ukraine or Eastern Europe and Canada. And of course, they take Canadian values and they, you know, export this into their homeland, and they talk about democracy and individual rights and minority rights. But also they bring news from the homeland into Canada. Canada, if you look at Canada's social media space, especially on Twitter, that the Ukrainian diaspora is extremely active. They're connected to the Kiev embassy. They're connected to all sorts of actors. And they become like a kind of informational conduit to the crisis.
And this mobilizes the society.
Absolutely. And there's research that shows that actually when the Ukrainian diaspora mobilize in Canada, they actually force other actors in the Canadian space to engage with them. It forces the Canadian government to actually talk about those issues more. But of course, a lot of these activists that are Canadians, but also keep ties with Ukraine, become prime targets for, you know, Russian disinformation and doxing campaigns. And we've seen indication, for example, that sometimes the Russians are trying to engage with these Ukrainians and trying to either delegitimize them or threaten them in that space. A good example of this is that not this time, but during the Crimean crisis, we saw a lot of allegations about LGBTQ communities. And in some respect, we have a lot of this too, right? There's a lot of Eastern Europeans from the LGBTQ community who are leaving these societies and come to Canada because we're a lot more tolerant toward these things. But the Russians were using this narrative of saying, well, you know, Ukrainians and Canadians are all, you know, LGBTQ, and trying to kind of discredit our population. The funny part is that it doesn't work that well. Russian disinformation campaign in Canada doesn't work really well. We're very resilient against that, mostly because of our Ukrainian background and our Ukrainian population. And somehow when you think about societal resiliency, like having this mixed population of immigrants allows us sometimes to weather some of these storms because we have alternative views and alternative approach and alternative vectors of information that comes in and can challenge those things. Mm-hmm. That's why Canada was always a strong supporter of Ukraine. Before the Crimean crisis, we were one of the first ones to, you know, declare, like, recognize their independence. Yep. One of the first, we helped them denuclearize in the 1990s. We've always kept this kind of very strong relationship, even though sometimes we were quite critical of corruption within the Ukrainian political system. We were always there to help and wanting a better relationship. That never changed. And that means we're very resilient against Russian disinformation, at least on Ukrainian war.
You know, in looking at the challenge of disinformation or other forms of foreign interference. Of course, while all eyes are understandably on Ukraine, Russia's not alone in doing this. China, to mention another big player. And I think a perhaps overlooked dimension of this entire challenge is that upon taking a global look, we see that actually pro-Russian and pro-Chinese narratives are triumphing in many parts of the global South. questioning key global players like Brazil or India or South Africa, we see that the West evidently has not perhaps made the necessary investment to strengthen resilience in those countries. How do you assess the global picture? And do you see any signs of substantial collaboration or parroting between, you know, Russia, China, Iran, other autocracies?
That's a good question. And it's hard to answer this. I think we're still in the infancy of understanding mis and disinformation and how social media, you know, changes a little bit the ball game in terms of propaganda and state-owned narratives. And in this context, I think democracies have been maybe overly focused on their own problems with, you know, 2016. And we were seeing Russian disinformation campaign in data in 2014, for example. When the Canadians were looking at the, you know, Trump election, we weren't kind of surprised because the data actually showed that they were doing this before that. But for sure, I think we've been in the West being overly concerned about its impact on our own society and kind of overlooked other actors or other states in the world that might feel that impact. And I think now, like, the future will be also to find ways for these groups to actually engage with each other. It's interesting because in Canada, for example, we have a large Francophone community. And we know, for example, that Russia and China are using the Francophones, Africans, to sow disinformation. Usually that sips into France and then to Canada through these diasporic groups. So the interconnectedness of all these transnationals or people with dual, triple nationalism have an impact. And somehow we don't really have a global answer to misinformation and disinformation. We actually don't know what to do with it, how to, you know, we're really concerned about our own resiliency, but we aren't concerned about the resiliency of other people. And that's probably one of the future that we'll have to kind of focus on. We've seen this, for example, on vaccine hesitancy. Like, some countries have been super resilient on vaccine hesitancy. Nigeria, for example, we have a data set on Nigerian conversation. They're extremely resistant to vaccine hesitancy. They push back. They have like a really interesting governmental campaign that pushes and for vaccination. Vaccine uptake is actually not bad. Whereas in India, there's this very strong anti-vaccine narrative that is coming from India, tied to the Gates Foundations, all those kinds of assumptions. And they're vulnerable to these things. So I think different countries in different ways are vulnerable to misinformation campaigns on different issues. And it's going to take us a long time to kind of untackle all of these issues and how it affects the Western world, but also how the Western world affects the rest of the world.
Maybe to conclude on a bit more of a forward-looking question, I think within this information war that we all live in, inevitably each of us is being told every single day, you know, you are part of the information space, whether you like it or not, you're being targeted, you're being manipulated, you're being attacked. And I think it's one thing to warn people and a very different thing to give people a sense of agency that they can actually do something. You know, I'm becoming a bit skeptical about whether just repeated warning in and of itself accomplishes the desired effect. What would you say is the way forward toward giving people, ordinary people, a sense of empowerment in this regard?
I don't have the answer for this because I think we're still trying to figure this one out. And I think also we don't have, like, we have a lot of hypotheses of what, you know, how we can fight disinformation, but we don't have a lot of data that actually shows this. For example, debunking and fact checking, the research on this is all over the place. And in some indication, it doesn't work. In other indication, it works, but it's temporary. In other studies that I've seen, it actually reinforces people's assumption of attack of your identity. So they entrench more. I think as a society, we are now living the digital transformation and we haven't really come to terms with what that means for social life. And each new technological revolution creates these new problems. Each platforms have their own issues. Some of them are anonymous. Some of them are open. Facebook, Twitter, like how disinformation works on those platforms. Often we make the assumption that they're the same, but it's not true. Like older people use Facebook, younger youths, TikTok and Instagram, and all of these things mean different things for us. I think as a society and as a world, we're going to come to terms with time to identify these things. I'm kind of an optimist. I think we'll solve this issue, but maybe not, you know, next year or the year before. I think we're getting more resilient than we were in 2016. I think a lot of us now understand better the information space. I think sometimes we underestimate the impact it has on some people. Mm-hmm. And we saw this with vaccine hesitancy, how like people, some people were completely impervious to, you know, sanitary measures and were dead set. And we've seen this all across the world, and other actors have to kind of come to terms. But I think we're in a learning process, and we'll learn the norms and rules and maybe the legal framework around these issues as we move forward and as we start to understand better that space.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. I'm inclined to believe your optimism. Jean-Christophe, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.